We come here from many places and we come seeking many things. Some come for the company or just the stimulation. Some bring unspoken joys or pains that need the closeness of others. But beneath it all, we come in the hope that here, somehow, we may catch a glimpse of something enduring, something which can support and nourish us, coax us toward a better life and a better world. We come to attend to those things which sustain and feed us. We come to attend to our roots. It is good to be together again, for it is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. I was going to write something heavier for centering this morning, and then decided that the whole sermon is stories, and I thought instead I would bring you something light that's a story that I don't believe I've ever used here before. It's an odd little piece from left field called The Duck. Now we are ready to look at something pretty special. It is a duck riding the ocean 100 feet beyond the surf. No, it isn't a gull. A gull always has a raucous touch about him. This is some sort of duck, and he cuddles in the swells. He isn't cold, and he's thinking things over. There's a big heaving in the Atlantic, and he is part of it. He looks a bit like a mandarin or the Lord Buddha meditating under the bow tree, but he has hardly enough above the eyes to be a philosopher. He has poise, however, which is what philosophers must have. He can rest while the Atlantic heaves because he rests in the Atlantic. Probably he doesn't know how large the ocean is, and neither do you. But he feels it. And what does he do, I ask you? He sits down in it. He reposes in the immediate as if it were infinity, which it is. That is religion, and the duck has it. He has made himself part of the boundless by easing himself into it just where it touches him. I like the little duck. He doesn't know much, but he's got religion. I've said this before, but I need to stop watching Jay Leno's jaywalk segments. A woman who stares at a huge photo of Colin Powell and says, "I've never seen that man before in my life." A man who isn't sure what country the Vietnam War was fought in. The woman who, when asked what the two sides were in the Civil War, guessed that it was between East and West. And these were all college students. Those of you who watch the show more regularly than I do will have your own favorite list of appalling answers from American voters. It seems undeniable to me that the quality of education in our country has fallen drastically in all areas of the humanities, as well as knowledge of world events. This week, I was given an article from the local paper that was written 5 years ago. It compared the education of eighth graders in 1997 and 1907. Here are some of the questions from the test given to eighth graders in 1907. In 1907, eighth grade students were asked in their arithmetic test to find the interest on an 8% note for $900 running 2 years, 2 months, and 6 days. They were asked to reduce 3 pecks, 5 quarts, and 1 pint to bushels. They were asked to define words including zenith, deviated, misconception, panegyric, talisman, and crypt. Among the 10 questions in geography were: name 2 countries producing large quantities of wheat, 2 of cotton, 2 of coal, and 2 of tea. And name 3 important rivers in the United States, 3 of Europe, 3 of Asia, 3 of South America, and 3 of Africa. Also in history, students were obliged to give a brief account of the colleges, printing, and religion in the colonies prior to the American Revolution, and to name the principal campaigns and military leaders in the Civil War, and to name the principal political positions which have been advocated since the Civil War and the party which advocated each. The professor of humanities who wrote this article in 1997 said reading this exam took his breath away, and he bet that most university students today couldn't pass it. I'm quite sure they couldn't on the jaywalk segment. We've come a long way since 1907, he said, but it's certainly not the high road that we've taken. And he concluded by saying, "A small world is long gone, as are the standards that made this nation exceptional. And we reap what we sow." We're not only slipping badly in basic skills, but in our awareness of the size of the world and the role that decent citizens in the world's most powerful country need to be playing in it. I'm glad that there are a lot of good and dedicated people working at writing and publishing textbooks, and I'm glad that I'm not one of them. The many layers of politics involved in textbook publication would make me nuts. Textbook publishers are harassed by special interest groups from everywhere, each trying to put their own spin on what is taught to our children. There are corporate groups who want all talk of economics to stress the free market economy and identify that kind of capitalism with American democracy. Right-wing groups want America's heroes to be white Christians. They want creationism taught in biology textbooks as a viable scientific theory. And they want history books to omit or play down the murderous role of Christian armies during the Crusades. Jewish and Muslim groups want to check anything that mentions their own special interests, and the list goes on. I'm being led to understand that the truth is that it's hard or impossible to get very liberal or multicultural messages into textbooks in any strong way if the publisher hopes to sell them. Some books are scrutinized by so many special interests, it seems a wonder that books dealing with controversial topics get published at all. But the teacher guides that accompany textbooks aren't under this much scrutiny for some reason. These guides give teachers other information and ideas for teaching the courses. Still, even if we could somehow fill out teacher guides, even if we had some power to help our public schools begin educating the character of our children again, we couldn't go back to the McGuffey readers. The world has changed too much. And a liberal education, especially in the humanities, is much more important than it was 100 years ago. Several people have asked me this week, and it seems I hear this question a couple times every year, why there are no Unitarian schools in the way that there are Catholic or Jehovah's Witness schools. I think it's a good question. Maybe it'll happen someday. And maybe that's the only way we're likely to get the kind of education we sit here in the wings whining for In the meantime, without the power to get decent humanities education back in public school curricula, and without our own schools, I've realized this week that all I'm really doing here is fantasizing. That's all I have to offer you today, a fantasy trip into the kinds of character-building ideals I wish our public schools taught, and a few ideas for how they might teach them. So I'm going to tell you some stories. To keep it manageable, there are three lessons, I think, we must teach our children if they are to become people of the 21st century. And they aren't exactly the same points that the McGuffey readers taught in a very different era. So the form here is that I'll define a point and then tell you some stories that can be used to teach it, to make it come more alive. The first point I think we have to teach in moral and character education, and you may find your own words for it, the point is that we are all brothers and sisters, children of God, and the hope of the world. All of us, all the peoples in all the countries in the world, male and female, white, brown, yellow, rich, poor, weak, and powerful, all of us. We are all brothers and sisters, children of God, and the hope of the world. How could teachers make this point in memorable ways without ever even approaching, much less violating, the separation between church and state? Very easily. Here are a few stories taken from religions and folklore all over the world. They're different flavors, different styles. They're all making the same kind of point in different ways. The first one is very modern. A family goes to a restaurant. The waitress comes up and takes the order of the parents first, and then she turns to the 7-year-old boy. "And what'll you have?" she says. "I'll have a hot dog," he said. Before she can write it down, the mother cuts him off and said, "Forget the hot dog. Bring him a steak, mashed potatoes, and carrots." The waitress ignores her. "What would you like on your hot dog, ketchup or mustard?" The boy sits up a little higher and says, "Ketchup." There's one hot dog with ketchup coming up, and she leaves. In the shocked silence afterward, the boy suddenly sits up quite tall and turns to his parents and says, "You know what? She thinks I'm real." The Buddhists tell us more elegantly that every one of us has within us a Buddha seed. Everyone has within us that sacred possibility of becoming awake, becoming enlightened, becoming an aware and holy person living an aware and holy life. And our task, the Buddhists say, is to look beyond the surface of others, to know that their Buddha seed is there, and to speak just to that part of them that's capable of high things, rather than the parts that are capable only of less. The Jews have a similar story going back probably 2,500 years. There are 36 people in the world, they said, who are capable of responding to the suffering that is part of the human situation. And it is for their sake that God permits the world to continue. We don't know who they are, and neither do they. So it's terribly important to treat everyone, including ourselves, as if we and they might be one of the 36 people for whose sake God permits the world to continue. Sometimes we can't see it. Sometimes both children and adults get beaten down, get buried under bad teachings, bad teachers, bad mentors, or just life situations where all they can try to do is survive. That's the real world. There's a story to address this too. It's a true story and a modern one. It comes from the physician Rachel Naomi Riemann, who's been one of my favorite authors for the last year. One of the most amazing examples of the power and persistence of the life force, she writes, is in the plant kingdom. When times are harsh and what is needed to bloom cannot be found, certain plants become spores. These plants dampen down and wall off their life force in order to survive. It's an effective strategy. Spores found in mummies thousands of years old have unfolded into plants when given the right opportunity. When no one listens, some children form spores. In an environment hostile to their uniqueness, when they are judged, criticized, and reshaped through approval into what is wanted rather than supported and allowed to develop into what they have to offer, children wall the unloved parts of themselves away. People may become spores young and stay that way throughout most of their lives, but a spore is a survival strategy, not a way of life. Spores do not grow. They only endure. What you needed to do to survive may be very different from what you need to do to live. Those are some of the stories that teachers would, in my fantasy world, use to teach the first point of character formation to all children. We are all brothers and sisters, children of God, and the hope of the world. The second point is one for which you might also find your own words. My way of putting it is that the whole human sound goes up only from the full choir, that we each have only a piece of the truth. The truth we need can only come through open dialogue and collaboration with those who see things differently than we do. Arrogance prevents growth. This one's easy to teach. The most famous story is one of the oldest from the Indian culture. It's the story of the blind people and the elephants. You all know the story. A bunch of blind people stumble on an elephant, which they've never experienced before, and they grab onto the part of it that's closest to them, and they try to define the entire elephant by only the part that they've experienced. So the one near the trunk, an elephant, is like a big snake. For the one grabbing a leg, it's like a tree. To the one hold of the tail, an elephant's like a rope. To the one who's grabbed the ear, an elephant is like a big leathery leaf, and so on. Now this story is not about elephants. It's about blindness. A shorter story comes from the Islamic tradition with a wonderful bite to it. To a visitor who said he was seeking the truth, the teacher said, "If what you really seek is the truth, there's one thing you must have above all else." "Oh, I know," said the visitor, "an overwhelming passion for it." "No." "No," said the teacher, "a constant readiness to admit that you may be wrong." And a folk tale tells the same story in a different way. The devil once went for a walk with a friend. Don't ask me where the devil found a friend. They saw a man ahead of them stoop down and pick something up from the road. "What did that man find?" asked the friend. "A piece of the truth," said the devil. "Doesn't that disturb you? Don't you want to take it away from him?" asked the friend. "Oh, no, no," the devil laughed. "I love it when they find little pieces of the truth. They turn them into beliefs and they're willing to kill for them." And from Africa comes a story about salvation or religious pluralism. A little girl saw a monkey grab a large fish out of a stream and carry it up into his tree. "What on earth are you doing?" she shouted at the monkey. "Can't you see?" called back the monkey. "I'm saving this fish from drowning." The sun that gives light to the eagle blinds the owl. Monkey salvation can't save a fish, and fish salvation can't save a monkey. And the Sufis tell this witty tale to make the same kind of point. A dead man suddenly came to life and began to pound on the lid of his coffin. The lid was raised and the man sat up. "What are you doing?" he said. "I'm still alive." His words were met with silent disbelief. Finally, one of the mourners said to him, "Friend, both the doctors and the priests have certified that you're dead, so you're dead," and they buried him again. The third point I think we should teach all of our children is the most important one, but it can only be learned if the first two points are understood. It is this: our task is to reclaim the world for these noble values. These ideals aren't new. They've been preached by every religion I'm aware of for thousands of years. Here the stories just abound from traditions all over the world and throughout history. For this has always been our most important task: to reclaim and restore the world. The 16th century mystical Jewish teachings of the Kabbalah say that in the beginning was Ein Sof, a great holy light containing all the holiness and light in the universe. It exploded, and sparks of that light went everywhere. There is such a spark within each person, they say. And our job is to find those holy sparks and to nurse them into flames so that together we might restore the world. Some stories make the point much more modestly. A couple went to their advisor, asking him how they could stop their endless quarreling. He said, "Just stop claiming as a right what you can ask for as a favor." These achievements of character aren't easy, because life also involves some suffering which can numb or even derail us, as we all know this. Of course, there's a story about this too. It's another modern one, another one from Dr. Riemann. It's about oysters. "An oyster," she writes, "is soft, tender, and vulnerable. Without the sanctuary of its shell, it could not survive. But oysters must open their shells in order to breathe water. Sometimes, while an oyster is breathing, a grain of sand will enter its shell and be a part of its life from then on. Such grains of sand cause pain, but an oyster does not alter its soft nature because of this. It does not become hard and leathery in order not to feel. It continues to entrust itself to the ocean, to open and breathe in order to live. But it does respond, slowly and patiently. The oyster wraps the grain of sand in thin, translucent layers, until over time it has created something of great value in the place where it was most vulnerable to pain. A pearl might be thought of as an oyster's response to suffering. Not every oyster can do this. Oysters that do are far more valuable to people than oysters that do not." Still another story, and a clever one, comes from about 25 years ago, from the hippie era. It took place on Easter Sunday morning in a high church, an Anglican church. It was so high that the usher was a dignified 80-year-old man who wore a coat and tails. The place was packed, and after church had started, even after the sermon had begun, this hippie came in. He was barefoot. His hair was long, dirty. His clothes were torn, tattered. Some said he probably smelled. He got by the usher while the old man was turned away, looking at something else. The hippie sauntered down the aisle, and he couldn't find a place to sit, so he walked all the way to the front of the church, sat down on the floor cross-legged before the first row under the pulpit. The old man noticed from behind what had happened on his watch, and he slowly but deliberately walked down the aisle toward the young man. Everyone sitting in the seats thought to themselves some variation of, well, the hippie deserves it. I mean, of course the old man's going to ask him to leave. The hippie should have seen what kind of a church this is, for God's sake. The old man got to the front, walked up to the hippie, took off his shoes and sat down beside him, cross-legged. The minister stopped in his sermon and he said to the congregation, "The words I say to you today you won't even remember next week, but for the rest of your lives you will never forget what you just saw." There's one last old story. Could have come from any tradition. I'll make it Buddhist. The teacher asked his students how they could know when the night had ended and morning had come. "When there's enough light to tell a cow from a horse," said one. "Wrong," said the teacher. "Well then," said another, "when you can tell the difference between an oak tree and a maple tree." "Wrong again." "Well then, how?" students asked. The Buddhist said, "When you can look into the face of any other man and see your brother, and when you can look into the face of any other woman and see your sister, then it is morning. Until you can do that, no matter where the sun happens to be, it's still nighttime." It is morning when the Buddha seed, that spark of light from the creation that is within all of our hearts, comes to light and comes to life and begins to define us and our part of the world. This brings us back to Ezekiel's dream from last week. It was Ezekiel who put the words into God's mouth that made God say he would take out of us our heart of stone and put into us a heart of flesh and would put his own spirit in our body. We reclaim and restore the world when we've found the Buddha seed in our hearts and in the hearts of others. The medieval Christian mystic Meister Eckhart called it a God seed, naturally. It's the same seed. But the seed has become a spore, hiding where it's safe, hoping that someday we and others might find it, might set it free, might let it flower and help us grow into a new kind of world. It was Ezekiel's prayer. It's still ours. Until then, we just have each other, ourselves, our hopes, and these stories.